Tommy McNeil. At least 52 inmates in a Brazilian prison were killed during a riot in northern Brazil Monday. The superintendent of the Altamira prison in the Pará state said 16 of the 52 inmates who died were decapitated. It took officials about 5 hours to end the clashes that began after one gang infiltrated another part of the jail. The count of victims could rise after authorities finished searching all areas involved. The incident was reminiscent of riots in May when 55 inmates were killed in gang-related violence at four prisons in the neighboring state of Amazonas. Human rights groups have accused the government of Brazil of doing little to deal with the country's notoriously troubled and overcrowded prisons. Prison population swelled from about 500,000 inmates a decade ago to an estimated 841,000 last year. A Saudi coalition airstrike on a market in northern Yemen has killed at least 10 people, including children, and wounded more than 20 others, according to medics and rebels. The missile slammed into a market in Sada province Monday in an apparent retaliation for a Houthi rebel drone attack on a Saudi airbase. A coalition spokesman accused the Houthis of attacking the market themselves to spite Yemenis who opposed them. The Iranian-backed Houthis have stepped up their missile and drone attacks on airports and military targets on Saudi territory as a response to continued coalition airstrikes. The Saudi airstrikes against the rebels have wiped out thousands and entire neighborhoods and killed thousands of civilians since the year 2015. U.S. President Donald Trump's choice for the next director of national intelligence is John Ratcliffe, an ardent supporter of the president who was harshly critical of former special counsel Robert Mueller. This is VOA News. Authorities in the western U.S. state of California continue looking for a motive after a gunman killed at least three people at a garlic festival Sunday afternoon. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The gunman has been identified as Santino William Legan. Police Chief Scott Smithy says Legan cut through a fence and started shooting. He had an assault-type rifle.
It was purchased legally in the state of Nevada on July the 9th. Of this year.
The chief says police arrived and engaged with the suspect in less than a minute.
Despite the fact that they were outgunned with their handguns against a rifle, those three officers were able to fatally wound that suspect, and the event ended very quickly.
Three people were killed, including a six-year-old boy. Smithy says the motive remains unknown. I'm Ed Donahue.
The U.S. and China are reviving trade talks on Tuesday, but the hopes for significant progress are low. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
2 months after U.S.-Chinese talks aimed at ending a tariff war broke down, both sides are trying to temper hopes for a breakthrough. Negotiations resume this week when American trade officials meet a Chinese delegation in Shanghai. They're expected to touch on an array of disputes that has grown to include tension over Chinese tech giant Huawei and the control of technology. Hopes of a breakthrough are low, though. On Friday, President Donald Trump said he didn't know if they're going to make a deal and he doesn't care, repeating his claim that the U.S. is prospering. I'm Charles Ledesma.
President Trump has expanded his attacks after a weekend of bashing a leading black congressman. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
The president says his tweets that Elijah Cummings' majority black Baltimore district is a disgusting mess where no human being would want to live were not racist. Instead, he says Cummings is racist for not helping his constituents. This morning, the president blasted civil rights advocate Al Sharpton, who went to Baltimore to condemn him, tweeting, "Al is a con man, a troublemaker." Sharpton says he'll keep making trouble for bigots.
If he really thought I was a con man, he'd be nominating me for his cabinet.
Aides say the president's comments were hyperbole, but they come after his racist tweets against four congresswomen of color. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Two U.S. service members have been killed in action in Afghanistan in what appears to be an insider attack. The NATO-led Resolute Support mission Monday said only that two Americans are dead. It has not released their names pending notification of their families. A U.S. official later confirmed the deaths were the result of so-called green-on-blue attacks, during which an Afghan service member or an attacker wearing an Afghan uniform fires on U.S. or allied forces. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 30th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. There was new violence Monday on protesters in Sudan, this time high school students.
These protests were mainly organized by the secondary school students who were unable to, like, find a means of transportation to go to their schools.
That's reporter Michael Atit in Khartoum, who abducted Tanzanian freelance journalist Eric Kabendera. The banned Nigerian Islamic Movement plans to challenge a court decision labeling the group as a terrorist organization. We look at trends in private capital flows to low-income countries in Africa. And Amnesty International calls for the immediate release of Cameroon opposition leader Maurice Kamto and his supporters.
What we are saying is that there should be independent investigations into these matters. And the same goes for the violence that arose at the Kondengi prison last week.
Marie Evelyn Pitrose-Barry is the director of Amnesty International West and Central African regions. And there are global health fears as the malaria parasite develops drug resistance. And those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, has condemned the fatal shooting to death of at least five high school children and the wounding of schools in El Obeid, Sudan's North Kordofan. The children, ages 15 and 17, were protesting the commencement of the school year amid current political uncertainty in Sudan. Abdullah Fadil, UNICEF representative in Sudan, said in a statement that no child should be buried in their school uniform. He called on the government to investigate and hold all perpetrators of violence accountable. Reporter Michael Atit in Khartoum says the Sudanese Professional Association and the Forces of Freedom Change have called for mass protests to demand an end to violence against protesters.
What happened in Sudan yesterday, protesters have been killed, like eight of them, according to the Sudanese medical doctors. But this figure has been disputed by the ruler of Northern Kordofan State, which is the military ruler who is acting as the governor for that state. The incident happened in El Obeid town, which is around 500 or 600 kilometers west of Khartoum. The protest started obviously as a reaction to the report that was released by the public prosecutor over the weekend, stating that only few numbers of like 87 of the protesters were killed during the crackdown on the protesters, and something like 160 plus were the number of injuries. The second thing is there has been a little bit shortage of fuel, so which led to also shortage of buses. So these protests were mainly organized by the secondary school students of the higher school who were unable to, like, find a means of transportation to go to their schools.
This latest information about the protesters being killed, this could add fuel to, as you said yesterday, a report on the use of violence against protesters in June came out and it was being disputed. Now we have a new report of killings of protesters.
Yes, of course. It's a very tricky situation. People protesting against or disputing a figure of a report, and instead, the Sudanese security forces reacted also by killing more protesters. The incident of El Obeid has a lot of reactions across the country. Here in Khartoum, last night, there was a lot of protests going on, and the roadblocks are almost coming back. Protesters are blocking the road. Some roads are inaccessible by bus or by vehicle. You are unable to use it because the main roads are all blocked by the protesters. And this morning, the Sudanese Professional Associations and the Forces for Freedom and Change, I saw on the social media calling on the pro-democracy protesters to come out in millions, whatever number they could come out, to, like, protest against this brutality attack and demand the military council to immediately agree to the constitutional declaration, the paper which the forces and the military council are expected to begin the talk on it today.
In the meantime, the protesters and the military council are expected to resume talks soon on finalizing the transitional government.
Yes, of course. Based on the invitation from the African mediation, the two sides are expected to resume the talks today in Khartoum. They are expecting to deliberate more on the constitutional document, in which, if that is done, together we'll make a final power-sharing deal between Military Council and the Forces for Freedom and Change.
Michael, thank you very much again for speaking with us.
Thank you, James.
Reporter Michael Atit speaking with us from Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Amnesty International has called for the immediate release of Cameroon opposition leader Maurice Kamto and his supporters who had been detained by the government. The group has also called for an independent investigation into allegations that the Cameroon Secretariat for Defense violated the human rights of Kamto's supporters. Local media reports say the Secretariat for Defense tortured Mr. Kamto's supporters, including beating. More than 100 Kamto supporters were arrested during a peaceful demonstration against President Paul Biya's electoral victory. Kamto has rejected the outcome of the presidential poll. Marie Evelyn Petros Barry is the director of Amnesty International's Western Central Africa regions.
Maurice Kamto and 100 other opposition members were trying to demonstrate pacifically and to uphold their rights of freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. And they were arbitrarily arrested and they are detained at the Secretariat of Defense. And on 11th July, it was decided that they could be tried by a military tribunal. This is not in compliance with international law, because civilians cannot be tried by civilian courts. It's not in compliance either with the African Commission recommendations and standards regarding civilians who should not be tried by military tribunals. So it's been 6 months since Maurice Kamto and about 100 opponents have been in jail. And we are calling for his immediate release, because his only fault was not a fraud, but was to uphold, his human rights.
Why is Amnesty International also calling for an independent investigation into allegations that at least 60 opposition members were tortured or their rights were abused by security forces in Cameroon? Who is to investigate this, by the way?
Well, it would be good if there was an independent investigation, but at least the judicial authorities of Cameroon need to look into that. There are two issues. The first one is that nearly 60 people, including 6 women, were released last week. And these 6 women out of 59 people reportedly, after we interviewed them when they were released, explained that they were tortured, that they were exposed to ill treatment, that they were beaten, that they were forced to walk like ducks in the mud, that they were really traumatized, being beaten by sticks, by belts, and insulted. And therefore, some of them were admitted in hospital when they were released.
How do you respond to supporters of the CPDM or the ruling party who say that these allegations are false and that these opposition members are trying to tarnish the reputation of the government and, by extension, the party?
Well, we are not responding to that. We are responding to human rights abusers. Amnesty doesn't have a say in elections per se. We have a say in human rights issues, and we want people to be able to demonstrate pacifically. We want people to be able to have their freedom of expression, their freedom of assembly. So what we are saying is that there should be independent investigations into these matters. And the same goes for the violence that arose at the Kondangi prison last week, where supposedly excessive use of force was used by. We are also calling for an independent investigation on that.
Marie Evelyn Petros Barry is the director of Amnesty International's Western Central African regions. She spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 30th. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. In Tanzania, the family of freelance journalist Eric Kabendera is demanding answers as to his whereabouts. Kabendera was abducted Monday from his home by what his wife said were six people who claimed they were police officers. Mrs. Kabendera told the Citizen newspaper that the man said her husband was wanted by police, but the police said they know of no arrest at the Kabendera's home. The Committee to Protect Journalists says it is concerned for Eric Kabendera's safety. As a freelance journalist, Kabendera's work has appeared in a number of publications, including Britain's Guardian newspaper. Neville Mina is the secretary of the Tanzania Editors Forum. He said Kabendera was probably taken because of his writings.
They took him from his home, in the name that they are going to take him to Oyster Bay police stop. And later this evening, the report from the police, they have confessed that they have took him from his home and they are interrogating him. And maybe they can arrest him later if those investigations or those interrogations on him come to the climax.
Why do you think he might have been targeted?
We can't know because I have not any clue, or I was not even contacted him before. What I can say, you know, this man is a regular contributor with The Economist in London. And as you may be aware, in Tanzania now, you write anything, report anything, you know, might be in trouble. It doesn't matter what you have reported is true or not. So my speculation is that maybe he was held because of what he usually writes in the reports on the economic relating on Tanzanian economic trend. That's what I am speculating.
The initial information we have is that the police had denied knowledge about this. And are you saying that as of late last night, that the police said that they were interrogating him?
Yes, the initial report came from the police denying that they know nothing about that. In Dar es Salaam, we have three police regions, I can say. He's from Kinondoni. So the police from Kinondoni, initially they say that they know nothing about him. But later, the police regional commander from Kinondoni just confessed that they have Eric.
Initially, the Tanzanian foreign minister, apparently in an interview with the BBC, said that the journalist had disappeared and died. But then he later retracted. What do you know there on the ground?
Our ministers are politicians. They can say anything today and they deny the information tomorrow. But when the information comes, especially from the police chief, like the regional police commander, who is the top spokesperson when something like that happens in his region, we get to know that we can count on his statement. That, and you know, this statement was so much public to the public, and the journalists actually interviewed him, and they have just immediately after he has confessed, the social media started rolling that information that the police have confessed. So it is all over that, okay, this man disappeared in such kind of mysterious circumstances, but later the police have confessed that they have him. And of late, there's nothing from the police contradicting that statement. So we can be at least sure that he's safe in the hands of the police.
You monitor media situation in Tanzania. Does this happen frequently, or this is just an isolated case?
No, it's not an isolated case. Right now, this time around, things have been happening. No, we have the pending case of Wazoni Gwanda, who has not been seen for close to 1.5 years. We don't know whereabouts of him and so kind of things. People have been disappearing. People have been abducted. Some human rights activists have been in trouble. So there's a lot of self-censorship because of this kind of pressure and this kind of situation.
Neville Mina is secretary of the Tanzania Editors Forum. He was speaking from the capital, Dar es Salaam. Trends in private capital flows to low-income countries surprisingly increased after the global financial crisis of 2008 in Africa and now provide almost as much finance as foreign aid in some countries. Nancy Lee, one of the authors of a new study from the Center for Global Development, said those flows are also going to non-resource-rich countries.
So for non-resource-rich African countries, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Uganda are among the top 10 low-income country recipients of FDI in the world, which just shows you that these capital flows are not simply driven by, you know, mineral, oil and gas and other mineral extraction. They're driven by the opportunities that investors see for investing in Africa in other sectors to reach African markets or to reach larger markets outside Africa or in neighboring countries. So that's good news for Africa. It means that investors are making a long-term commitment to productive capacity in Africa.
Another thing that you guys found that's interesting is China is an investor and not just a lender in these countries as well, because we all know that China often lends for infrastructure needs, et cetera. What kind of investments is China making into the continent?
Well, interestingly, people tend to also think that China is really driven almost entirely by resource endowment in its investment choices and is really lending for resource extraction reason and investing in resource extraction reasons. But when you look at the data, what you see is that about a quarter of foreign direct investment from China in low-income countries in Africa is in mining, but all of the rest, 75%, is outside mining. A lot of that investment is really in construction. So I think a lot of what China is doing in its foreign direct investment, as well as in its lending, is building infrastructure.
What about the policies, the domestic policies in many of these countries? I know there's a lot of countries covered in the study, so obviously there's a wide variation. Are domestic policies keeping up, I want to say, with this investment?
Well, the question of policies is really important because, again, there is this impression that if the motivation for investment is resource endowment and mineral extraction, it doesn't really matter what your policies are, what low-income countries' policies are, because they really are a captive of their resource endowments. What you actually find, especially for investment in non-resource-rich countries, is that there's a significant positive relationship between the quality of regulatory policies and investment climates and the ratio of private investment to GDP. So we're seeing exactly what you'd want to see, which is that policies matter. Countries with better policies tend to have higher ratios of private investment to GDP.
Nancy Lee is the lead author of a new study from the Center for Global Development. She's speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington. The banned Nigerian Islamic Movement, a Shiite group, says it plans to challenge a court decision labeling the group as a terrorist organization. The announcement comes after a court in the capital, Abuja, instructed the Buhari administration to ban the group, citing its acts of terrorism. The move followed protests by members of the group, which left a police officer, a journalist, and at least six demonstrators dead. But officials of the group say the ban is illegal. They say they are peaceful. Meanwhile, the government says security institutions could take any necessary action against the group. Galba Shehu is spokesperson for the President Buhari's government.
It means there are no enforcement. It means that this IMM, which is declared by competent law as a terrorist organization, will not have an operating space in Nigeria. If anybody comes forward to proclaim its membership, then they are also they are terrorists. So therefore, this is the position of the law.
Now, some people are saying if the government holds that position, it violates the constitution, which ensures freedom of religion. How do you react to that?
In Nigeria, there is freedom of religion protected by the constitution, but there is no freedom to engage in terrorism. What the Nigerian government is doing in this case is to outlaw a terrorist organization. The government of Nigeria is not outlawing Shiite sect of the Islam. No abiding citizens who are Shiites, and we believe they are in majority among the Shiite community. They have no business with this ban. They have nothing to worry about. It's nothing to do with them. The government is taking measures to stop terrorism by visiting the Nigerian Shiite community. So I think that this has to be clearly understood.
Some people have said that there appear to be a foreign government that is influencing the group. Is this the position of the government? Is the government seeing a foreign hand in this?
I've not been briefed about them. If it is there, I've not been briefed.
The Islamic Movement of Nigeria has condemned the labeling of the group as a terrorist organization and has vowed to appeal, since they said this violates their very existence protected by the Constitution. How do you respond to that?
Well, they are free. They are at liberty to America allowed the appeal, so they can do it before it, but I'm convinced them. And I believe that Attorney General of Nigeria will also go before the same court and show proof of their participation in terrorist activity.
Galba Shehu is a spokesperson for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The most effective drug used to treat malaria is becoming ineffective in parts of Southeast Asia, and unless rapid action is taken, it could lead to a global health emergency, warned scientists. Writing in the Lancet journal, researchers from Thailand's Mahidol University and Britain's Oxford University say parasites that carry malaria are developing resistance to a key drug combination across multiple regions of Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and Vietnam. Henry Richwell reports.
The report warns that the parasite Plasmodium falciparum, which causes the most lethal form of human malaria, is becoming resistant to the first choice drug, DHA piperaquine, in parts of Southeast Asia, with patients seeing a failure rate of 50% or more. The situation is so critical that scientists say the treatment should not be used in Cambodia, Vietnam, and northeast Thailand because it is ineffective and contributes to increased malaria transmission. New treatments must be considered, says Sturgios Mostios of the University of Northumbria.
It might be opportune at this point in time to explore whether or not we should bring together different new classes of medications so that when the problem starts becoming more substantial, there is a solution potentially that works at the multi-drug level.
The report says urgent action is now needed to eliminate falciparum malaria from the region. Otherwise, the resistant strains of the parasite could further spread to other parts of Asia and Africa, potentially causing a global health emergency.
All it takes is a ship with infected individuals or a pool of water where the mosquitoes are getting into Africa, and then slowly that parasite establishing a foothold. The likely scenario, however, will be that improvement of healthcare on a day-to-day basis in Africa will create the opportunity for the parasite to evolve resistance.
Currently, malaria vaccine trials are underway in several African countries, but drug combinations like DHA piperaquine remain vital in treating malaria, especially in countries with poor health systems. Since 2014, global progress against malaria has stalled. There were an estimated 219 million cases and 435,000 related deaths in 2017, most of them children under the age of five in sub-Saharan Africa. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Briefly, before we leave you a summary of Africa news, the United Nations envoy for Libya is calling for a truce during the upcoming Eid al-Adha holiday, along with such confidence-building measures as a prisoner's exchange and freedom of those jailed without charges. Qassem Salami accused both parties of serious human rights violations. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Tune in to VOA programs on your radio and on the internet. We bring you news, news about Africa and the world 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. News, talk shows, sports, music, everything you want to hear. Available on the radio and the web on The Voice of America. Find the VOA program guide at www.voanews.com and check local listings for stations near you that carry VOA programming.